So with that, please join me in welcoming our speaker this evening, Tom N. from the WE Group of San Diego, California.
I'm an alcoholic. My name is Tom Navaris.
Hi, Tom.
And my sobriety date is January 3rd of 1989. Thanks. No, really, thanks. I mean, thanks. Yeah, well, I guess this is one alcoholic talking to 400 other alcoholics. What a group. You guys have an awesome group here. I love the way that you welcome the newcomers and welcome newcomers. And I love the way that you celebrate Chip's and birthdays. That's great. I'm a guy who, I bounced in and out of AA for 5 years. In that 5 years, I could never get 30 days sober. I started coming to AA when I was 24, and I didn't get sober until I was 28. For me, there was a difference. We used to sit in bars and talk about being alcoholics, and we'd laugh about it and slap each other on the back, and I'm an alcoholic, yeah, me too. But it was very, very different than what happened on January 2nd of 1989. And that's when I realized that I was powerless over alcohol. And you know, that would translate to me in years prior to that in a lot of different ways. It would translate, I didn't realize that I was saying that I have the power to drink. But what I would say is I can have one beer. I can have a glass of wine. I can do 25 cents of an outside issue, you know. And what I'm really saying to myself is that I have the power to drink. And on January 2nd, I realized that I was absolutely powerless. And I don't mean to have a play on words or whatever, but to me that was quite different than saying I was an alcoholic. So why I'm here and why I'm active and why I love the enthusiasm of a group like this is because it keeps me conscious of the truth. And the truth is just that I'm powerless over alcohol. Because right before I drink, I get just unconscious enough to believe the lie. And the lie is that I'm not. The lie is that I have the power to drink. So I'm going to tell you a little bit about my unconscious life and my continuum of a more conscious life. And when I was a kid, my parents were good parents. We had a completely dysfunctional home, but until I was 11, I lived in L.A. and went to a private school and wore a uniform and, you know, shiny shoes and a tie and salt and pepper pants, and I didn't like that. And one day, a neighbor across the street who I idolized because he was so against everything that I had to do. His name was Ray Amler. And he had tattoos, and he smoked, and he slicked his hair back, and he had calendars with naked women in his garage, and he had motorcycles. And I wanted to be just like him. And he sat me up on a mailbox when I was probably about six, and he split a Coors with me. And I drank Coors until January 2nd of 1989. This is not a Coors commercial, wrong state, sorry, but I was a really nervous kid. I used to pull my eyelashes out, and I would have to go to confession, and it was really bad because I knew God could see in the dark. You know, I knew I was going to hell with hairy palms and blind. It was just really a struggle for me. It was. And my dad, you know, I found out later, you know, why he was acted frustrated and why he seemed so angry. And but that's how I remember my dad. He was very angry. He was very short-tempered. He was very impatient. You know, he's got like 6 or 7 degrees, and I always remember him at his desk looking at his back growing up as a kid. And we had moved to Marina Del Rey, and there was they had a party. We had a bar in our house, and my parents weren't really drinkers. When my dad did drink, he drank Coors. But a bottle of Wild Turkey dropped on the counter, and it broke. And I remember my dad got up on the counter, and he started lapping it up like a dog. And everybody was laughing, and he laughed. And I don't think I'd ever seen him laugh. And whatever that was on the counter made him different. And I was ready for some different. So the next day I filled up a glass of Wild Turkey and stole a couple of my mom's Pall Malls and went and sat on the side of the house and got sick. Bad. Got really sick. And right about that time we were moving. We moved from L.A. to San Diego, and where I live now. And, you know, I went from, it was the last 3 months of sixth grade, and I went from a private school to a public school. And that's why I'm an alcoholic. Not really, but... And I went from wearing salt and pepper pants. This is in 71. I was born in 1960. That was another thing. I was pissed about missing being a hippie, you know. I was always trying to catch up with that. But anyway, I went from wearing salt and pepper pants to wearing bell bottoms that were striped and paisley shirts, and I thought that was the best thing ever. And that summer between 6th and 7th grade is when I started drinking. And it, you know, it started out as, you know, fun, I guess. I mean, it wasn't really fun right then, but it evolved into being a lot of fun. First it was kind of scary and peer pressure and all that kind of stuff. But once I started drinking that, I couldn't wait for the next chance to do it again. And the neighborhood I lived in, we all our parents had bars and liquor cabinets, and we would all steal our parents' booze and steal their money and wait for a buyer outside of liquor stores. And so I started drinking alcoholically when I was 13. And immediately, my heroes went from people like Bart Starr and Johnny Unitas into Mick Jagger and Jimi Hendrix. And I really wanted to be Mick Jagger. I mean, that lifestyle I loved. I loved that music. I loved what it stood for. I loved that it was anti-establishment. I loved all of that, you know. I mean, I loved it. And so the early 70s, well, all of the 70s was a blur, pretty much. But it was a lot of fun. You know, it was great music and great outside issues, and you know, I was too young to get in really, really bad trouble. I was going to juvenile hall a lot and stealing cars and doing all that kind of stuff and breaking into houses and just, you know, dumb, drunk kid stuff. Nothing really violent. And school had gotten to be just in the way. So I quit going. I took a what was called a proficiency test. It was equivalent of a diploma. If you passed it, you didn't have to go to school anymore. And I took that when I was 15, and I knew I passed it, and I quit going to school. By then, I had already moved out of my mom's house when I was 15. I look at my kids now. I have a 24-year-old, an 18-year-old, a 13-year-old, and a 12-year-old. And they, except for my 24-year-old, he just went in the Air Force, but they all live with me. And I look at how old they are and what I was doing when I was that old. God. I would kill them if they did half the stuff that I did. I remember when I was 16, not going to school anymore, full-blown alcoholic. And I started shoveling concrete. And I still do concrete work. I remember then that it was a big deal. We were, minimum wage was $1.75 an hour. And we were getting $2 an hour cash. Cash. And that, you know, that's $16 a day. That's a lot of money, you know. Especially when you can buy a lid for $10 and a quart of East Side costs 55 cents and you get a nickel back on the bottle. And, you know, everything was, it's all relative, I guess, but it sure seemed like a lot of money back then. I continued on. Losing the fun was just evaporating. And by the time I was 19, I thought that if I got married, that it would straighten me out. And I found a gal who was, she was a checker at Vons. Her dad was the vice president of the Carpenters Union, and he had a bunch of oil wells, and she seemed like a great target. I mean, she would have made a great wife. And I ended up marrying that poor gal and drug her through hell. We were married for a couple of years, and then I ended up marrying somebody who was exactly like me 2 years later. So that started falling apart. I had had a son, and I left my second wife. I was 24 and had a one-year-old son. A week before his first birthday is when I left. And then things for me with my alcoholism got really, really, really bad. I had gone to enough school. I started going to blueprint reading classes and took a prep course for the state surveyor's license. I'd never finished any of them, but I would go long enough to learn buzzwords. And enough buzzwords to lie my way into jobs I couldn't really do. And I had somehow gotten a job at that point when I left my second wife that I was making an incredible amount of money, which is still unbelievable to me, because that was all, you know, that was right on the verge of my peak of alcoholism. And in the next 11 months, I had gotten 3 drunk drivings. And I don't know about here, but in California, they were pretty pissed about that. And so after the first one, I started coming to AA meetings. And then for the next 5 years, I would come into AA typically on Mondays, typically broke, typically with a hellacious hangover, typically with an armful of holes. And I don't know what was different about the Monday that I got sober. Really. It was like thousands of other Mondays before that. But I, you know, when I talk about the party was over, It was just not fun anymore. You know, the guns are loaded, the doors are locked, the shades are shut, and I'm on a 5-day run again. And when I party like that, I after about day 3 of the hostages, I start hallucinating and seeing things under my skin and trying to pick them out. And, you know, that morning I got up and I looked at myself in the mirror, and I didn't know what I was looking at anymore. All of the Mondays before that, I had had that punishing God guilt and remorse that I grew up with. I felt bad about spending the rent. I felt bad about not seeing my kid. I felt bad about borrowing my mom's car and bringing a bus bench home in the side of it, you know, the next day. I felt bad about all the stuff that I did and the stuff that I didn't show up for. And that morning when I woke up, I didn't have that guilt. When I say I didn't recognize myself, it was much deeper than the way that I looked. I didn't recognize myself. Whatever was left of me was gone. And when I heard myself say that I was going to die that way, and I didn't care. I just didn't care anymore. The fight was over. I had surrendered. Alcohol was my master. I was going to die that way, and I don't care. And when I heard myself say that in my heart, it scared me. And I called a friend of mine who'd been sober for 6 months. And he came over and, geez, it's early. I should go get drunk some more. He came over and I meant my story, not physically. He took off work that day, and he came over and spent the day with me. And that day, he gave me the most precious thing that any of us can give each other. And he gave me his time. You know, he gave me his time. And it was because somebody had given him their time. And he knew what to do. He was only 6 months sober, and he saved my life by showing up. That's what we do. I saw so many of you here tonight show up, and you had a job. You're here for a reason. You know, I'm just a dumb concrete guy, but, you know, when it talks about the root of our problem is self, even I can figure out the solution has got to be to get out of myself. And I saw so much of that here tonight, and I love that. I'm passionate about that in Alcoholics Anonymous because I watch it change lives. And so anyway, I was too embarrassed because of the way that I looked to go to a meeting that day. And that was January 2nd. And of course, I had a train set that I meant to give my son for Christmas that was still in a box. And he helped me put it on a piece of plywood and set it all up. And that's what we did that day. And I went to a meeting the next night. And I started doing things that I had never been willing to do before. I didn't really realize that I wasn't willing to do them before. I just wasn't doing them. And the kind of pain that I experienced from realizing what I had turned into motivated me to do something different. It still motivates me to do something different. I hope I never forget that pain. I hope I never forget that experience. In that 5 years when I was bouncing in and out, I had gone to this meeting, and I was really trying to be an AA. I was really giving it my best shot to be sober and be active. And I saw the steps on the wall, and they horrified me. you know, especially 4 and 9. If you're new, 4 and 9 are going to horrify you on the wall. They're not that bad in real life. And I had heard people talking about getting sponsors. Well, I was at this meeting, and it was at an Alano club, and they were having a potluck the following Friday night, and I don't think I'd ever been to a potluck before, but they said, yeah, well, everybody bring something and we share it. So I had planned, you know, I'm going to go to this potluck, and I'm going to bring, the only thing that I really knew how to cook was a pot of beans. And I brought a pot of beans to this potluck, and everybody loved my beans. I really felt a part of. And I got up guts enough to ask this guy to be my sponsor. And I swear to God, what he said to me was that I was going to have to perform oral sex on him every day for the rest of my life if I wanted to stay sober. And of course I said, heck no. Now, 3 nights later, I'm laying on the floor because I fell off my bar stool at my favorite bar called the Silver Spigot. And the bartender, who I, in my opinion, was worse than me, was standing over me, shaking her head with that look. Now, when I told this guy that I was not willing to do that to him, he said, "You're not ready." You bet your ass I'm not ready, you know? I know today what he asked me if I was willing to go to any lengths. But that's not what I heard. So anyway, I'm laying on the floor. And she's looking down at me, that look of disgust, and she says, "You need to go to AA." And I thought that took a lot of nerve for her to say to me. And I told her, "Hey, I was just there, and they told me I wasn't ready." And I drank for a couple more years. And I got to January 2nd of 89. And so I must have been in a lot of pain because I asked somebody else to be my sponsor. And what I heard was yes. And we started going through this deal, and you know, it's just, in hindsight, what an awesome thing that happens to us. God, I'm going to lose it. It's just, what an awesome thing that happens to us. You know, this guy only had a couple of years sober. And he was just bumbling through the book and sharing whatever experience you can have at 2 years sober with me. And it worked, you know. I saw these people busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. I saw these people getting dressed up for meetings. I saw people showing up early and staying late. And it was funny because those were the people that were happy. And those were the people that were staying sober. And I was tired of staying sober for 2 weeks. I was tired of saying I'll never drink again in the morning. You know, waking up, puking and peeing blood, and being drunk by noon. I was tired of that. I don't know if I really want, I don't know when I first got sober that I really wanted to stop drinking. That morning, I lived in this tiny little apartment And there was a little square, about 18-inch square, that came through this little tiny window of sun that was shining on my floor. And I kneeled down in that little spot, and I just said, God, please don't let me live this way anymore. And I got up and called my friend. He had been my best friend since I was 13. And I hadn't seen him in a while, but he had gotten sober, and I didn't want to live like that anymore. And I didn't know what else there was, because it had been like that for so long. I didn't even remember what it was like to be normal. I think I started drinking alcoholically so young and started getting married so young and all this stuff so young. I didn't know what normal was. And in the second half of the first step, when talks about unmanageability, I didn't really get that until we started talking about decisions that I had been making and how that was working for me. So I really, there's a thing in the ninth tradition that I love. It talks about living by spiritual principles. And it says, at first we do because we must. And that was really my experience. I mean, at first I did it because I could not stand another second of myself. And I was ready to do whatever it took to not have to be exposed to me again. I had to do it. I had to do it. If I wanted to be different. There's a lot of ifs and whens in the book. If I wanted to be different. If I didn't want to live like that anymore. And it goes on to say that, and this is my experience too, that ultimately, we obey spiritual principles because we enjoy the kind of life that such obedience brings. And I love the kind of life that such obedience brings. I do. This whole deal to me, in hindsight, if I could boil it down to just a couple things, for me, is all about consciousness and unconsciousness, which it talks about over and over again in the book. Sanity and insanity, which are the same thing to me. Consciousness and unconsciousness. And the truth and a lie. And my whole life had been an unconscious lie. And I didn't know it. I didn't know it because I was unconscious of it. And today I try to live a little more and more and more in the conscious truth. And the steps I don't believe are the truth. I think they're a guide to the truth for all of us. That's my experience. So I'm powerless over alcohol. My life's unmanageable. Second step, you know, there better be a God. There better be a God. Otherwise, I'm screwed. When I was, I had 30 days sober. I had a truck that was mine. It was registered in my name. I had insurance. I was totally legal. And it had been a long time since all those things had happened at the same time. And an old girlfriend of mine called me, and her boyfriend was out of town, and she wanted to come and spend the weekend with me, and I was pretty excited about that. So I went to go pick her up, and I could hear music on in the house. I knock on the door, I could hear music on in the house, and she didn't answer, and I ring the doorbell. And she didn't answer, and this is before cell phones. So I went down to the gas station to a payphone and called her. And she didn't answer, and I knew she was in there. So I went back, knock again, ringing the doorbell a little more aggressively, back to the gas station, call again, back to the door, knock on the door again, ring the bell some more, and I'm driving down the road, leaving, upset. And I remember I was talking to myself, I was talking to God out loud, driving my 65 Ford truck that was registered to me, and I had a driver's license in my pocket. And I said, God, thank you so much for letting me see what it's finally like to have 30 days sober. Thank you so much for letting me have a truck and registration and a driver's license and insurance. But I'm going to drink. And I pulled into the parking lot. This was a Friday. I pulled into the parking lot of my favorite topless bar, and it had burnt down that weekend. All right, man, you win. And I have not had a desire to drink from that day to this. I really didn't have a desire to drink in the 30 days prior to that. It was just the only tool that I had. I didn't like how I felt, and I wanted to change it. So taking the third step, the first time I took the third step and got on my knees and prayed with my sponsor, I really didn't understand what was going on. It's just I had sobriety brothers who had gotten sober around when I did, and they were ahead of me, and I wanted to catch up in the steps. And I was so new, I don't know that I could understand much. So don't feel bad if you feel like that, because I did. And I wrote an inventory, and it was out of a guide. You know, again, you know, these people that sponsored me in early sobriety, they were doing absolutely the best they could. And I didn't drink. You know, they were doing the best they could. So, at 10 years sober, I went through a gnarly divorce. I had married the love of my life. I had had custody of my two kids. Oh, I had a daughter. Right after the girlfriend not answering the door, topless bar burning down incident, this girl who I had brought home from a bar one night called me up and had found the Lord and wanted to come over and tell me about it. And later on that night, there was talk of God. And my daughter was born on November 4th. On her second birthday, see, I live in San Diego, and in the early 90s, it was bad, construction-wise. It was recession, and it was bad, and I was working in Laguna Beach, and getting to go to a lot of really cool meetings. I mean, I would stay in Laguna Beach half the time and get to go to the women's club there on Wednesday night with Dr. Paul and all these giants, you know, Tom Whalen, and just all these guys I absolutely adored. And, you know, then we'd go to the Pacific Group a lot, and it was awesome. But anyway, I was in total denial about this little girl being mine. And I had no desire to do the responsible thing. I really didn't. But my sponsor made me go do a paternity test, and I found out she was mine, and I started taking her. I'm a couple years sober now. Didn't I start it? I was going to start talking about something at 10 years sober. I'm sorry. I have like AA ADD really bad. But so my daughter. I started picking her up and taking her to the park and doing different things with her on weekends. And about this time, I had gotten custody of my son, too. He was 7 now. I went to go see her on her second birthday, and it was a really hot day. And she had on a sweater that used to be white, and it was black and filthy, and she had feces running out of her diapers, and she had no food or no clothes, and her mom was a mess. I didn't know her mom, but I watched her getting worse and worse and worse. She was starting to prostitute, and I could tell she was, you know, doing a lot of drugs, and I just looked at her, and it's not because of any virtue or anything else. I had to take her. I said, I have to take her. And so I'm taking this 2-year-old home, which I have absolutely no idea. Early sobriety is hard enough, man. You know? It's like, Jesus. Went home and gave her a bath, you know, because she stunk. And I took her to Mervyn's, and this is not a Coors or a Mervyn's commercial. I took her to Mervyn's and bought her clothes and toys and took her back home. Her mom had told me that the night before, that two guys had come into her apartment, and one of them took her into the bathroom and raped her, and Hannah was out in the living room with the other man, and she doesn't know what happened to her. I couldn't see any signs of anything, you know. I'm you know, touching her like she's radioactive or something. So I took her to the doctor the next day and had her checked out. She was fine. And she didn't know me. She didn't know me. And I absolutely fell in love with that little girl. You know, kids are just so awesome. Kids are so awesome. I told my boy, I said, you know, you got a sister now, and and I really don't have any idea how to be a dad to a daughter. And he unbuckled his seatbelt and scooted over on the bench seat of my 65 Ford. It's not a Ford commercial either. And he put his arm around me. He says, "We can do it, Dad." And we did. We did. So, eventually she talked. I would get up in the middle of the night, and she would be crouched down in a corner, just in the hallway, just staring out in the dark, you know. I know that feeling. And there's a two-year-old little girl with two strangers. And I had to go find out about daycare. I paid this lady $100 to potty train her. What was really horrifying was her first period. I'll tell you that right now. That was... So anyway, at 10 years sober, I had gotten married in sobriety. And this lady was actually the love of my life. And her and I had two boys. And I went through a divorce at that time. We got divorced. And what happened was my ninth step. You know, I had gotten sober in 89. I hadn't paid taxes since 83. And I had made decent money, you know. And I asked my sponsor what to do, and he says, "Well, when you're sick, you go to the doctor. If you have tax issues, you go find a tax guy." So I went and found this tax guy and handed him a boot box full of whatever documentation I had, and he straightened it out. You know, he told me what to do. I'll get back to that. Painful divorce. I was in so much pain at 10 years sober. And I had started a business. And when I had started this business, I put a $35 ad in a little teeny local paper. And it was in, that ad had been out for 2 days. I mean, all this stuff in AA is happening to me that's just incredible. I can't believe my life. And I put this ad in, and I get a call, and this lady says, we did 385 houses last year, and I fired my concrete guy this morning. Would you like to come and do our work? And, I mean, immediately my business just took off. And, yeah, exactly. Now, you would think that would be a good thing. But I do business alcoholically. And if there's a little bit of a fire, I'm going to blow on it and make it a bonfire. And that's kind of what happened with my business. And I was making a lot of money. And at 10 years sober, I was miserable. You know, I'm driving around getting speeding tickets, jumping out of the truck, yelling at everybody. 10 years sober. Nice example. And I had to do, I've done many inventories on money. And how money, I get the illusion of empowerment that allows me to treat somebody how I wouldn't normally treat them. So I'm going through this divorce, and I had on the outside what looked good. But I was miserable. And I was in so much pain, I got another sponsor, and I did not like this guy. But he really, really knew the book. And he showed me stuff that I had read in the book for 10 years and never heard. It was the first time in my sobriety that I had really gone through the steps, you know, I feel. I was in enough pain to be open to having a new experience in Alcoholics Anonymous. And what I do with guys today is exactly what he did with me, is I start at the blank page in the beginning of the book, and we read every page together. And as we come across experiences that I've had, I share them with them. When they do a four-step, I do a four-step. You know, I bring mine out and show it to them. And that pain has always been a huge motivator to me. I watched her forget that she was powerless over alcohol. After we were divorced for about a year, she started drinking again. And she just got out of jail last Sunday. My daughter's mom has been in prison for 14 of the last 18 years. So 3 years ago, I got custody of my two boys. So I got a house full of kids at home that are really glad that I'm in AA. You know, they've seen what happens to somebody that was in AA that starts drinking. We have a house where I'm on my knees praying with guys a lot. They see that a lot. We have AA parties. I mean, they have an AA life. They didn't get drug around. I would call my older son to come over and babysit the younger kids while I went to a meeting, and he's like, what? He's going, why don't you take him, why don't you drag him around like you did me? You know? I drug Michael and Hannah around for years to meetings. And you know what? I would imagine they heard a lot of things that kids probably shouldn't hear. You know? And I'm not sure that I would do that again like that. But it's what I did. And our house is a happy house. We have an AA house. And without Alcoholics Anonymous, I wouldn't have a life. You know? I would not have a life. I don't know if I would be alive. My dad, who I disliked growing up, I take care of today. He's 82 years old and has Alzheimer's, and I'm over there a couple times a week. Yesterday, him and I went and got bad haircuts together. It's so funny because there's so many actions that I've taken in Alcoholics Anonymous that I did not want to take. You know, a paternity test. You know, taking care of my dad. Things like that I take, it's like mechanical. I take an action and I have a spiritual experience. It's absolutely incredible. When I was first sober, they'd say, stand at the door and shake hands. I still do that today. There's a lot of things that I hear in Alcoholics Anonymous that drive me nuts. And one of them is the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over, expecting a different result. In my opinion, that's a definition of stupidity. Insanity to me is finding something that works and stopping doing it. That is crazy. You know, what I was taught here works. I've been sober for 19 years, and when I was first sober, I was kind of a parrot. I didn't have any of my own experience. But I would hear people who had experience, and I would hear them say things that I thought sounded cool. And I would run around repeating those things. And I would watch how those people sponsored people. And when I started sponsoring people, I was pretty much right-wing, militant, missionary position Alcoholics Anonymous. There was one way, and this is how you got to do it. And if you're not doing it like this, I don't know how you're even alive. You know. And how I carry myself in Alcoholics Anonymous today isn't like that. How I sponsor people today isn't like that. And I'll tell you that one of the biggest things that I've learned is to be open to change. We sure hear a lot about that on TV now, change. I'm Tom Navarro, and I approve of this message. Something that I could be total hardcore believer in. This is the way it is. I'm finding that those lines really need to be erased in my life. And that I need to be open to a new experience all the time. Because there's so many things that the longer that I stay sober that I find out are just my perception. And in the third step, when I know today is very different to me than when I first got sober, it talks about take away my difficulties. And when I did that at 6 months sober, I didn't even know what my difficulties were. I thought that my difficulties were the circumstances in my life. My difficulties are her. My difficulties are the boss. My difficulties are the IRS. And they're not. My difficulties are my perception of the circumstances in my life. And my experience is that my perception is changing all the time based on new experiences. And I invite that. I invite that. I don't think I'm hard-line about anything. There's stuff that goes on in meetings that I don't participate in, but I, a lot less than I used to, talk stuff about it. And that's a big change for me, you know? My heroes, Alcoholics Anonymous today, are like that. You know, Tom Ivester is like that. My sponsor, Bob Darrell, is like that. And I love that. And I aspire to that, you know? because it doesn't feel good to have to cut somebody else down to make myself feel better. It doesn't feel good to demean somebody, you know? I mean, we're supposed to come in here and deflate our ego. And nowhere in the book does it say until you have 2 years and you start sponsoring people and you can deflate their ego to make yourself feel better. I haven't found that. I read the book a lot. So some of the experiences I've had that have changed my mind, that have changed my spirit, that have changed what I believe to be true, a lot of them happened in the ninth step. When I was a kid, my brother and I were in the import-export business. And my brother had ripped this guy off for a couple kilos. And these were the wrong people to rip off. And they had cornered my brother and I in a cul-de-sac. There was six or seven of them, and they had motorcycle chains and baseball bats. I was 14, 15. Two nights after that, they bombed our house and blew all the glass out of my mom's house. When I was going through my ninth step stuff, my sponsor told me, pick out the three that you don't want to make the worst. Pick out the three that you're most scared of. And the first one was my first wife's parents. They really, really believed in me. And I was, you know, I had hair halfway down my back and a gold Playboy bunny earring. And then they let me marry their daughter. It was insane. Anyway, I went to go make amends to them. And what happened was absolutely nothing like what I had pictured in my head for years. And I'm like, wow, that was easy. And then I went to the IRS. And that was expensive, but it was really easy, you know. It took me 10 years to make financial amends. You know, my sponsor told me, you know, you work hard, you're in a hard trade, and nobody wants your money. They want their money. And that's the truth, you know. Financial amends is not paying your bills. It took me 10 years to not owe anybody money that I had owed from before. And I don't even remember what the third biggest one was. But I do know that after my experience with the IRS, I called them up and they dealt with me. They made arrangements with me. And it blew my mind. My first wife's parents, that experience blew my mind. And I'm walking down this hallway of a corridor, or whatever you call it, of a bowling alley. And here's this guy who my brother ripped off. And I was a part of that, you know. And I saw him, and he was walking towards me, and it's a wide hallway, it's probably 20 feet wide, and it was like there was magnets in our chest. And I just, whoop, I walked right up to him. And I looked him in the eyes. And I said, do you remember me? And he said, yeah. And I know he had a gun. I know he could have easily killed me. I know he probably wanted to. And I said, I harmed you. And if there's anything that I can do to right the wrong that I've done you, I'm willing to do it. And he looked me in the eyes and he said, I don't know how he knew this. He said, I heard you're sober. Is that true? I said, yeah. And he said, as long as you stay sober, you and I don't have a problem. I said, right on. See ya. And what it talks about in the promises, you know, before I was halfway through, was coming true. The trust that I had in God completely changed. The love that I felt, the experience of the presence of God in my life changed like that. From taking action I didn't want to take. I just do all the same stuff that I did when I was new. I still put chairs away. I still make coffee. I still shake hands at the door. I have outside of meeting commitments. I do H&I work because I want to stay sane. I want to stay conscious of the fact that I'm powerless over alcohol. And when I do those things, it seems to work. That's my experience. You guys are an awesome, energetic group. And Mark has been so cool to me. Picks me up at the airport, takes me out to dinner, you guys are an awesome group. You're really fortunate that you can afford to get out-of-town people. I hope that I did a good job for you guys tonight. Thank you very much for having me.